Okay. My name is Brian Warner. I'm going to be talking about an anti-spam system I've been developing called PetMail. The website for this is petmail.lothar.com. The website for this is petmail.lothar.com. And there's a copy of this presentation on there if you want to play along. There are pictures of cute little sheep that I've rendered. You can download all the code. There's a mailing list there, all that good stuff. So I started developing PetMail about 6 months ago when there were a number of anti-spam proposals being floated around that I felt really would cause more problems than actually solve things. A lot of them weren't trying to solve the correct problems, or there were easy workarounds that you know the spammers will simply be driven into. Content filters are an arms race. You know, the spammers will pre-vet their message to make sure it passes the filters. And you just get more and more bizarre Baroque spam, you know, talking about enhancing your members so they can avoid, you know, using any naughty words that might trigger the filters. It almost more of a problem than that is that it causes self-censorship. Think about how many times you've changed the way you've expressed yourself because you weren't really sure if your recipient's content filter was going to grab it or not. Sender permitted from, verse MX, and domain keys are all designed to prevent forgery, not spam. What they're trying to do is to make sure that a message claiming to come from a domain is coming from an IP address that is authorized to send mail from that domain. That has its uses, but mostly it's about responsibility. It doesn't really cut down on the spam. And worse than that, it encourages spammers to take over even more computers with the Outlook worms, stuff like that, so that they can send mail from machines that are already authorized. Spammers are even taking over entire, they're forging BGP records to take over entire address blocks to get valid addresses to send their spam from. And then envelope-based whitelists just encourage spoofing. You know, when you accept people into your inbox based upon the from address in the message, then those million address CDs will just turn into million address plus valid sender address CDs, and you aren't really getting anywhere. So what is PetMail? PetMail is a couple of protocols implemented by an agent that runs on your computer and talks to other PetMail agents running on other computers. There are also a couple of simple servers that help those agents find each other. How does it deal with spam? The specific thing that it does is to reject non-pre-authorized machine-generated email. Everything else is just making life easier and making email more convenient to use. It enforces a recipient policy for all messages, so you can specify exactly who gets to send you what, and they know about it ahead of time. It's designed to make it easier for humans to communicate, because email is about humans talking to each other. The computers are just helping the process. In contrast to some of the other spam systems, anti-spam systems that are being developed, PetMail uses no centralized control. The recipient decides, is the only person who decides what is going to come into their inbox. It leaves no uncertainty. When the sender pushes the send button, they know right then whether the message is going to be accepted or not. It's not like the message gets sent and then some filter is applied later on, and then maybe you'll get a bounce, maybe it'll just disappear into a black hole. It also makes no attempt to support legitimate spam. There are some notions that it's okay if you spam as long as you don't do it too much. And some of the systems that are out there are designed so that the volume of mail that you send is somehow, you know, there's a cost that's proportional to the volume of the mail to make it okay for little spammers to operate. I don't have any interest in helping out that kind of business. And finally, it makes no attempt to be compatible with SMTP. This puts me firmly into the anti-spam kook category. There's a very funny list at Rhyolite.com of how to tell if you're in the anti-spam business too deeply. It also puts PetMail into the category of, wouldn't it be nice if we could just throw everything out and redesign it all from scratch? That's true. I won't make any attempt to convince you otherwise. However, there's still a lot of value in actually using it, developing it, running it, just like there's value in using PGP, even though most of your correspondents maybe don't use PGP. You know, you treat the messages coming in that are signed differently from the messages that aren't signed or encrypted in any fashion. Likewise, with PetMail, you can treat these messages differently. For instance, you don't have to do any content filtering based on the stuff that's coming in. So in addition to those, PetMail doesn't require any changes to the intermediate mail infrastructure. The mail relays do exactly that. They relay messages from one machine to another. They don't try to do any kind of filtering or authorization down at that level. The primary changes are running a different agent at your end and at the sender end, and there are a couple of simple servers that are set up in the middle to help them get together. Also, in contrast to some other schemes, it retains the capability for full anonymity, and it actually makes it more convenient, as I'll show you later if I get the time. And technically, it doesn't actually try to prevent unsolicited commercial email. What it's really doing is preventing non-preauthorized machine-generated email. But really, that's the most economical kind of spam to send out these days anyway. All of the stuff that fills my mailbox is that form of mail. The fundamental problem is time. I don't have to tell you why spam is a problem, but the one that I've been focusing on in developing the system has been human time. I'm dying, just like everybody else in this room, at the rate of 1 second per second. This is about how long I have left to live. Anything that consumes that time without my permission better have a really good reason for doing so. But balanced against that is generosity, because sometimes I want people to consume my time without having my permission ahead of time. You know, meeting other people is the entire point of having a social existence. And having computers and communications is a wonderful thing because it allows us to make connections that we couldn't have even imagined of 50 years ago. It's effectively free to communicate with somebody on the other side of the planet and to even find them in the first place based upon some common interest. That was just absolutely unimaginable several decades ago. So any system which damages that wonderful feature of the email system, of the computer communication system we have now, is a bad thing. You can make a strong argument that giving people unfettered access to your inbox is the very definition of free speech. But these two things are kind of at odds with each other. We've figured out how to solve it in the human sphere, people talking to each other. If we can figure out how to apply that to the computer sphere, then we can make computer communications more like human communications. The big difference about spammers is that they don't communicate like people. You know, there's always this kind of give and take, and if I'm trying to consume some of your time, I'm willing to put some of my time into it as well. Except for very unique situations like a lecture, it's really unusual and really impolite for one person to talk at somebody else for 30 minutes in a row and not let them get a word in edgewise.
If someone has their car parked next door and left the key with them, they're about to leave. So you may want to get that now.
So spammers don't communicate like humans. They have no interest in being personally involved in the millions of messages that they're sending out. Spammers are not people. I mean, cockroach jokes aside, spammers are a person with a whole bunch of computers. And these days, it tends to be a person with a bunch of your computers that they've taken over using, you know, the latest Outlook virus. So if we can make a difference between how spammers communicate and how people communicate, then we can apply that to bringing communication back down to the kind of human rate that we're familiar with. A lot of this is just about rate limiting. If it's about humans talking to each other instead of about computers just talking at people, then the spam problem would go back to the state that it was 10 or 15 years ago when it was just people posting inappropriate messages in a news group because they were trying to advertise some particular service. They still had to be personally involved in that. That was just annoying. It's not like the system-crushing onslaught of spam that we have right now. So the PetMail design is based around the idea of recipient choice. There are per-sender policies. Everybody that you communicate with has a little record in your address book, and you specify exactly what you'll accept from them. Anybody you don't know yet has to put some time into making contact with you. They're consuming some of your time, so they have to be willing to spend some of theirs. And that's human time, not computer time. So that means using CAPTCHA tests to verify that the sender is actually a human, or whatever other kind of challenge you want to apply to people to let them in your inbox for the very first time. It also seeks to optimize standard human communication patterns. When I talk to you, it's polite for me to let you talk back to me. The PetMail system can apply that to email and make sure that when I send you a message, I automatically grant you permission to send a message back to me. Likewise, if I introduce two of my friends together, I want them to talk to each other. If I send mail to two of my friends and want them to talk to each other, then the PetMail system makes sure that those people can exchange messages without going through extra hoops. However, the permission is always based upon what the recipient wants, and they have final say as to what actually can and cannot be sent to them. While we're throwing everything out and starting all over again, we can improve a number of other systems. We know that spammers will just spoof anything that they possibly can, and they'll send messages from any machine they can get their hands on. So we need actual cryptographic signatures in order to implement per-sender policies. We authenticate those signatures up to a reasonable point. Petmail makes no attempt to claim any kind of real-world identity with the public key. It just authenticates up to the public key. So you can be sure that the message you got today is from the same person that you got from yesterday. If you want to actually associate that with a real-world identity, you need to do something out of band. We encrypt everything that we can because we have those public keys available to us. We avoid revealing any information that we don't have to and make anonymity possible. Some of the anti-spam proposals are based around the idea of only accepting mail from, you know, well-known people with VeriSign certificates or something. And there's no real need for that. If you can restrict that the first message is coming from a human, you don't really care which human it is. Address mobility is a big problem with the current system because your email address really defines you. It represents your entire identity, and if you change it, then you lose connection not only with you know, all the people that have your email address but haven't actually contacted you, but all of your active correspondence. This makes it provides a lock-in that means the providers don't have to provide as good service as they really ought to. Yeah, just look at the way that the cell phone industry has changed over the last couple of months with number portability. You know, that you have to provide a better service if people can get just change it around. So Petmail seeks to decouple a couple of different pieces that the email address is currently bound to right now to make those services cheaper. And then finally, reliability. SMTP was put together in an era when the agent was very, very simple. You know, it was really just dumping, it was like a file pager for your mail spool file. And all of the reliability was put into the intermediate nodes. We can listen to the end-to-end argument and move the reliability, the responsibility for that back out to the end nodes to do end-to-end acknowledgments and retransmissions if the message doesn't go through. So this is the super dense one-page summary with all the words that I'm not putting into the rest of the presentation. There's an agent that handles all the interactions for you. The CAPTCHA service I'll show is abstracted out so that you can let the technology change over time and create a market for different services that do this validation for you. Your identity is defined by an ID record rather than an address. The email address is a pointer to that record, but once you have that record, once you're communicating with somebody, you don't need the address anymore since your agents can update each other with those records as they change. And it uses SMTP as a transport layer. It's a convenient way to get messages from one place to another and have them get queued up on the opposite side. Or it can use Remailer Network or Jabber or anything else that will provide a queued message facility. The Petmail agent that I'll show you today can run as a proxy behind your MUA. It speaks POP and SMTP so that your MUA can... You can use your standard, you know, Mozilla or Balsa or whatever you want, Eudora. To compose and look at messages, but then Petmail actually sends the message and talks to all of the other agents. This functionality could also be merged into Mozilla as a plug-in, something with some better technology there. The agent allows you to specify different identities about which you can reveal as much or as little information as you wish. Each of these identities is fully described by a record with a bunch of different fields. Once you have this record, you have everything you need to know in order to communicate with somebody. That includes whatever names you wish to publish. You could leave this blank if you want to be anonymous. It includes the addresses that point to this. There's an expiration time so that these records can be cached and expired just like DNS records. There's the policy, the permission that you apply to all of the new senders that you haven't given more specific permission to. There are a set of transports to say, how do you actually get a message to me? And then it's extendable, so different, you know, plugins within Petmail can advertise different capabilities or put different information in here. Every time you change this record, it gets published out to everybody who needs to know about it. Your address book is just like a regular email program address. It contains, instead of the email address of each person there, it contains the ID record. And it also contains the specific permission you've applied to that one sender and has a copy of whatever permission they've applied to you. Every time you change something here, your agent tells the other agent, this is what you're allowed to send to me. This is important because you want to have these policies available up front. When you send the message, you should test it right there and then. A lot of the big frustration, I believe, with challenge response systems is that you send a message, and then a day later, something comes back to tell you, oh, wait, I want you to do this extra thing. And there's no strong connection between the two. If it happens right up front, then it's just another part of sending an email message. It's much, much less annoying. The ID record is published out to different places. It gives you a question of how do you actually acquire one of these. Well, you know, most of the people in your address book are there because somebody sent a mail to you or one of your friends told you about that person. Those are all things the agent can take care of for you. Every time you get a message from somebody, it'll include a copy of your ID record, giving them enough information to get back to you. And if you refer to anybody else, it'll include a copy of their ID record. It's also something that can be armored. You know, you could send it by other means, put it on the web page, whatever. But that record is too big to fit in a business card, and it's too big to memorize. So we need names to point to it. These addresses are centralized identifiers that can be turned into an address server that will give you back an ID record. This service is computationally comparable to running an LDAP server. It's really pretty lightweight. It could be run over HTTP. All you're doing is storing maybe a kilobyte of data for every particular name. So it's very cheap to actually provide this service. If I think that Lothar.com is just the coolest domain name ever and that people would be willing to pay me $10 a year for a really cool name there, I could run this off my wimpy DSL line at home, because all it needs to do is give you back a kilobyte of data for a name, and you only have to do that when you send that first message to somebody. Once you have the ID record, then your agent goes through and validates, when you're trying to send a message to somebody, it validates that your message matches the permissions that they're giving you. The record points to a number of ticket servers, and it does this by URL. This serves to abstract out the CAPTCHA test. The ticket server, its job is to validate the person that's sending you some mail, and really what it's doing is implementing some challenge that you as the recipient choose. You can subscribe to whatever ticket servers you want by putting their URLs in your ID record. And then the agent, when it's sending a message to you, will go to those servers and find out what kind of challenge they offer. Different ticket servers can offer different kinds of challenges, so you can have a whole scale from, you know, really, really annoying, but you can be really sure that a spammer isn't going to be able to write a program to break it, to the other end of the spectrum where it's just, if you know, click here to prove that you're willing to click on something. You can have a wide spectrum of levels of involvement, and then the recipient can subscribe to whichever one of those they want. The ticket server can also offer different services to say, hey, this one is visual, this is an audible one, this is, you know, based upon an essay question, this one works if you know English, but not if you don't know English, whatever. The agent is mediating the communication between the ticket server and the user. The result of this is simply a signed blob of data from the ticket server that says somebody has passed some test or done, you know, some amount of work in order to send a message to some particular ID. Those tickets are used once, you know, the replay protection's in there, and you just include it in the message body that gets sent off to the recipient. Message gets signed, encrypted, and then put into a body. When it gets to the recipient, they do some stuff. They validate all the same things on the other end. You know, you have to do the validation on the receiving end. You want to do the validation on the sending end to make sure there aren't any surprises. The agent, when it's finished processing the message, if that message involved an actual email body that needs to go to a user, it puts it in front of the user. But these messages that are being exchanged between the different agents are that's happening kind of at the transport level. There can be inter-agent messages that don't actually involve the human, like when they're just updating these things. When they're just updating the ID records, they don't need to actually involve a human in the process. To get the message to somebody, we need a transport of some sort, and this is what the recipient publishes in their record. Any kind of queued message service will do. Jabber is one possibility. Anything that will let the agent that's maybe running behind a NAT box or a firewall go and retrieve messages that have been sent to it. So we can just use SMTP as a transport layer. We wrap the pet mail message into, you know, we armor it, we stick it into a regular email message, and then mail it to some address which is being pulled by the pet mail agent running as a POP client or an IMAP client. The address, the email address used for this is completely unrelated to the user's email address. It can be some kind of throwaway thing. It can change. You can have multiple ones. The agent can be pulling from multiple locations. It's solely being used as a transport layer. And this kind of brings SMTP, Simple Mail Transport Protocol, back down to the transport layer. We run a higher level application protocol on top of it. Or you could use a remailer network to provide for that transport. If you have a SERB reply block for a remailer network to get to the recipient, you could use that to send the message. I'll talk briefly about how to use this with remailers. The agent is in a really good position to restock somebody else with a series of SERBs. It can keep track of when those SERBs have been used, when they're about to expire, and then keep the sender stocked with a reasonable supply of these response blocks so that they always have at least one available to send in a new message. It can speak to another, two agents can speak to each other to keep these blocks up, or the agent can keep blocks stocked in a SERB server or a NIM server. SERB server is just like a NIM server, except all it has to do is provide those SERBs. It doesn't actually have to provide any of the email traffic. So it can be much simpler and involve a lot less bandwidth and computation size. The SERB request protocol can also include a ticket requirement so that you can rate limit the use of the consumption of these response blocks down to something at a human rate to try and prevent some of the denial of service attacks. End-to-end reliability is accomplished by having acknowledgments sending from agent to agent. If the acknowledgment isn't received in a reasonable amount of time, we retransmit. The messages all have sequence numbers that prevents replay attacks, and it also provides a convenient hook, a convenient pointer to do the acknowledgment message with. The intervening transport layer may provide us with some kind of negative acknowledgement. An email might bounce, and you might be able to parse the bounce, and the bounce might actually make it all the way back to you instead of getting dropped somewhere. If that happens, then we can use that to trigger a retransmission sooner, but it's not necessary. This is a big problem with the email system right now, is that bounces are generally sent to humans instead of computers because they're not reliably parsable. That turns it into another spam channel. So it's much easier if the agent can have a strong correlation between a message I sent and a response that came back so that the human doesn't have to be involved in that level of the protocol. Introductions are accomplished with control messages. When Alice wants to introduce her friend Carol to her friend Bob, she sends Bob a message with a pointer, basically, to Carol. In the agent, she clicks a button that says, tell Bob about Carol. She wants Bob to be able to send mail to Carol. For this to work, there are a couple of trust relationships that have to exist. These are buttons that you set up in your address book to say, I trust this person as an introducer, I vouch for this person. If those things are all there, then when Bob goes to add Carol's address to her to his address book, then his agent will send a permission request off to Carol directly. The agents talk to each other to make sure that this is actually allowed, and then Carol adds a permission and sends Bob this new update. If Bob doesn't type too fast, then all of this stuff can happen before Bob actually gets around to composing that message to Carol that Alice told him to go and send. And so that means Bob doesn't have to go through any of those capture requirements that some new person would. So the idea here is that standard human patterns should map directly onto this with, you know, minimum of friction. That kind of introduction turns into a permission lineage. So Carol has everybody in your address book that you've granted permission to is there because of something. It's possible that you sent them a message and therefore granted them return permission. It's possible you looked them up and, you know, gave them permission directly. It's possible that somebody has introduced them to you, and that creates this kind of tree of permissions. That is useful information because perhaps you gave Dave the ability to introduce you to new people, and then he sold out and introduced you to a whole bunch of spammers, and now you're getting a bunch of spam for them. Because the agent can keep track of all this information, Carol can click a button and say, right, everybody that Dave has ever granted permission to, or anybody down the subtree from there, revoke their permission, and while we're at it, revoke Dave's permission as an introducer. We are not going to trust him for that anymore. However, she can, if she chooses, let him still send mail and say, well, you can send me mail, but you're not allowed to introduce me to anybody new. As I envision it, PetMail would create a market for a couple of different kinds of services. At the moment, these things are kind of bundled together into the current email system. Your address is really being used for multiple purposes. It's used as an identifier, it's used to address a person, and it's being used to indicate how to actually get mail to you. And you could decouple those things, make those services easier, cheaper to run, and provide more competition, more flexibility to go and change these things. The address server is basically renting out cool, memorable, stable addresses. That's a service that you currently pay for by being employed in an organization, by looking at advertisements on Yahoo Mail. You know, it's a service that somebody is providing for you that has different values depending upon how useful it is. In PetMail, that's a separate service. The person providing the address to you or one of your addresses doesn't have to provide any transport services at all. Transport service is all about, is the queue reliable? Is there a machine available? Do the messages bounce? It's unrelated to, is it a cool name? So that's a separate service. And because Petmail can run over SMTP as a transport layer, you can take whatever random webmail account you have right now, as long as there's a way to automatically retrieve messages from it, and use that as the transport layer. The ticket server is a service of enforcing your desires in an automated, cheap fashion. It can be done with CAPTCHA, but you can imagine that, you know, if spammers spend $1 billion and create an AI that can pass all of these things perfectly, then what it really does, it's kind of like you're outsourcing this decision-making process. It's kind of like hiring a secretary to screen your phone calls. This is a service that may be worth paying for in some fashion, and depending upon how expensively or how cheaply they can go and implement it, that determines what their costs are. It's going to change over time as technology changes. You know, people develop new capture techniques, break old ones. So by having it be a separate service that is abstracted out and referred to by that URL, it is something that you can change at any time, and that creates a fluid market because there's competition for it. And likewise, the SERP servers is a fairly simple service, just like the NIM server. So petmail.lothar.com has the download. It's implemented in Python, runs on Twisted, spawns off GPG for all of the encryption. There's an apt-get repository there. If you're running Debian Unstable, you can just go and install the Debian file. There's a mailing list. There's a paper describing the design. There are also a couple of simplistic servers. There's an address server that just lets you choose whatever address you want, and there's a web page tied to that so you can see what addresses have been published up there and delete them if something goes wrong. And there's a really simple ticket server that just does the kind of, you know, show me a picture, type in the text kind of CAPTCHA. All the basic functionality is implemented in this release. Permission checking, ticket checking, that kind of stuff. I've not implemented the remailer support yet. Code is maybe like 20-30% there. Or any of the other interesting kinds of transports. Like, you know, one transport could simply be post a message to alt anonymous messages, and then the receiving agent can just go and pull it, you know, pull it at a uniform rate to see if anything matches. And I also haven't implemented the end-to-end acknowledgement control packets. The address server and ticket server are prototypes, but they serve to let you know how everything works. So the demo, the agent looks like that. So Alice can run, so this is Alice's agent, and she's created two identities. In one, she describes herself as Mr. X, and in the other, she just describes herself as Alice. Each of these ID records are controlled by, you see all of that? Yeah. This is the panel where Alice can configure everything that goes into that record. There's a local name that she's known as. There's the name information she's publishing to the rest of the world. And that would include, you know, in a fuller version of this, it would include company affiliation, organizational affiliation. Really, these names are there to let somebody who has received your record know what they have and who you are. And it could also be used as search terms for a search engine to go out and try and find people like this. The addresses that point to this record, the inlets specify what kind of transport you should use to get to me, and you can choose to pull a mailbox if you're using SMTP as a transport. For this demo, I'm just using a local TCP connection. The inbound restrictions, so this is the generic permission where you say, if you want to send me mail and I don't know you already, I'm going to limit you to 100 kilobytes and I'm not going to accept HTML. Some of the fields that are published in that permission record include message size and list of content type things that are valid. Ticket URL specify this is the kind of ticket that you have in order to send something to me. And then because this is extensible, you can go and, you know, choose a picture and that'll get included in the record that somebody else can see. In her address book, she has a bunch of different people. She can control the permission that is granted any one of these by just clicking things here. As soon as you change something here, it'll go and update it with the other person. Some of these people, she knows nothing more about it than they describe themselves as Mrs. Y, things like that. And then there is primitive MUA functionality in here to actually send and receive messages. So that's Alice. Now we look at Bob. Bob is over on this side. And he's described himself as a couple of people. When he wants to go and look up Alice, he does an address book lookup that contacts the address server, says, hi, I'm looking for Alice at lothar.com. He gets back her ID record and adds her into his address book. He can assign a pet name to her, whatever locally, you know, locally scoped name he wants. And this is then used when you go and send a message, if you want to, if you don't want to refer to somebody by their by the addresses that point to that ID record. He can specify the permission that he provides here. When he goes and actually sends a message, and sends it, then his agent tells him, this permission, this person's record says you have to get one of these tickets from the CAPTCHA server first, and it presents the challenge to him. It then signs, encrypts the message, sends it over, in this case TCP, jumping over here to Alice. She receives a message, and it gets put into her inbox. If she chooses to, then she can go and add the sender to her address book. So the only in the address book, it describes it as Bob Dobbs in scare quotes, because we don't actually know who this person is, and this is just the name they provided to us. So until she provides a local name of some sort, then he's always referred to as somebody in quotes. This permission right here is automatically granted when you add somebody to your address book. If we look back over on Bob's side, we'll note this thing right here. Their restrictions are outbound are specific. No ticket vendors are required. Alice can go and change this anytime she wants. She can say, turn off the box that says I'm going to grant you permission. After there's a delay of 5 seconds before it bothers sending it over, but if you note, watch this specific line right here, it pops back to generic. So Alice has just revoked Bob's permission. We can turn it back on again. Because we're using SMTP as a transport layer thing, we can do things like ping Bob. This is from agent to agent. It's not involving the person at all. And it has a side effect of updating that ID record, that permission right away. So now that Bob has specific permission, when he goes and sends another message, he doesn't have to go through the permission the CAPTCHA checking series. The message just shows up in Bob's in Alice's mailbox right away. And then in addition to this, so I told you before that this is currently running as an SMTP proxy and as a POP proxy. Here I have Balsa as an MUA, and it's configured to go and talk to Alice over that proxy. Down here you can specify the local port for the where to listen for POP and where to listen for SMTP. So from here I can say check all my new messages, and it just goes and shows you all those same messages that were in Alice's inbox. If I then send a message from here, then what it's going to do is speak SMTP to Alice's agent. Which will then take the message as if you just typed it into that panel, encrypt it, sign it, send it over to Bob's agent, and then it pops up over there. And you can see all the SMTP headers, everything that came through from there. Then you can, you know, reply to the message, and that'll automatically grant the return permission. Introductions work where you send mail to somebody and reference somebody else. For instance, if Alice wanted to send a message to Bob, and wanted to reference, Carol, and wanted to reference somebody else that's in her address book. Right, this is Mr. X sending the message, who has nobody in his address book. Alice, however, has several people in her address book. She can include that. So that's just a list of address nodes. Because the actual message format here is extensible, you can just put more nodes in there with different names. And in this case, there's a list of reference nodes that are including these ID records. When Bob receives the message over here, then he gets a button. The agent notices that reference node and puts up a button that says, here, add this reference. If he actually goes and adds it, then it's going to go and ask Carol for permission do the whole introduction vouch for thing that I showed before. So that's about it. Are there any questions? If somebody doesn't have permission, does it show up on the screen right away, or do they have to run some other program? This PetMail makes no attempt to be compatible with unmodified SMTP senders. So they have to be running a PetMail client. And then the client will tell them as soon as they hit the send button. It can even tell them before they hit the send button. As soon as they see the address that the person is sending it to, it can get the record and determine this person is going to need a ticket. So it can actually, pre-do a lot of that that computation before you hit send.
Does this break mailing lists?
No. So in PetMail, mailing lists are just another recipient. You give the mailing list, the mailing list is an identity, and you give it permission to send you mail. You can configure that because you can specify things like size of message. When a message is coming from a known sender, you can specify a maximum sending rate, basically an inter-message gap, so that you can say, I'm willing to let the mailing anything signed by the mailing list software show up, but it's in digest mode. I only want to accept once every 2 days. Likewise, you could also give permission. Being able to specify different permission to different people is really handy. You could say, I'm willing to give permission to my bank to send me messages, but only once a week, and they're not allowed to introduce me to anybody else.
What different web-based or what different graphic user interfaces does this work with?
At the moment, this is just using GTK. This demo is just using the Python GTK bindings. As a protocol, it could be incorporated into anything. You could put together a plugin for Mozilla Thunderbird. A webmail implementation would be a very easy way to make a seamless experience. Yes, I believe it does.
How long ago did you start working on this? And did you read my mind?
I started discussing this with a couple of people last summer when people were first talking about, I think it was SPF and domain keys first started popping around back then. And part of the development process was, well, what happens if you just break everything and require that everybody use new clients, which a lot of the other systems out there aren't willing to do. The requirement of still accepting mail from unmodified SMTP clients is really just kind of unworkable. You can't get around that very well.
Right. I actually, at almost exactly the same time, started a project that does almost exactly the same thing.
What's it called?
Cake.
Cake. Oh, yes. This is the cake guy.
Quick question. What happens if I know your ID? Can I send a mail and impersonate you? Like, how easy is it? I didn't see any encryption or public key.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Well, because you're not seeing the intermediate messages here. So this ID right here is the fingerprint of the GPG key that's being used to encrypt and sign all these messages.
Okay.
When the message shows up, it's signed and encrypted. And if the message does not have a valid signature from somebody that you already know, then that message... I have a slide for this. Then that message is not eligible to use the specific permission that you've granted to somebody. Wow, my machine is really thrashing. So, yeah.
The second
old laptops. Say again?
The second question I have is, for a new user whom you don't know, probably the only problem, after he tries to send you a message, he gets a image saying that type and to verify whether he's a valid person on the other end. All I'm seeing over there is that it actually adds a computational process. If a spammer has to do something like that, he just needs to add more CPUs and make some OCRs which can read those kind of stuff and do it. How far are we for a spammer to actually use this system for spamming?
It's an interesting question. So CAPTCHA research is a big part of AI research. CAPTCHA is the original Turing test that kind of defines a lot of what AI is trying to do. There are systems out there now that people think are pretty good, and part of it is that to actually do the OCR on it, you need a lot of compute cycles. It kind of becomes complicated. you could have a ticket server that requires something like hashcash. You could require a ticket server that requires that you call up a 1-800 number and talk to an operator for 30 seconds. You know, there's a whole kind of range there, depending upon how complex you want to get and how expensive it is to implement and how much burden you want to put on your sender. I think that there are visual capture techniques now that people generally agree would be really, really difficult to try and overcome. And the services that are out there, you know, LiveJournal, Yahoo, they have captures on their account creation forms that are apparently good enough. They're using them. Yes, actually, and I didn't make up the slide for that. But so there are several different attacks here, and I think this still addresses many of them. There's one that I'm going to call a Turing farm, which is where you get a sweatshop and you pay people minimum wage to just sit in front of an LCD screen and type in letters all day long. If you play around with the economics of that, well, they have to be able to read. You have to provide computers for them. The numbers I threw together, and they're in the paper at petmail.lothar.com. I've played around with some of the economics of it. If you have to pay those people $5 an hour and they can do a new capture result every 10 seconds continuously, then to do a typical million email a day spam run requires 116 people and $14,000, which kicks the economics of spam out by like two orders of magnitude. It requires that to get a break-even rate, they have to get something like 1 in 1,000 people actually buying what they're selling. And currently, their break-even rate is something, and that's just a break-even. Currently, they're hitting something like 1 in 100K, maybe 1 in 1,000,000K. The other attack is what I'll call a porn-fed spam farm, or porn-fed Turing farm, where you set up captcha, you serve porn pages, and say to get past a certain point, you have to go and answer a captcha. In the system, each one of those capture tickets only gets you one message to one person. So the economics of it still are not in the favor of the spammers. You can try and help a little bit. You can raise awareness. You can put the name, you know, some identifying information in the image to show what is being used for to discourage that. I think the simplest answer for that is just set up captures with capital letters that require two hands to answer. Next question.
You've called this pet mail.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, is that in reference to Mark Miller's pet name markup language?
Yes, it is.
Do you support translation of pet names within the body of the email text that I write?
That is not implemented at the moment, but it could easily be done. The idea is that when a message shows up, it's from an identity. You refer to that identity with a pet name, and that's how it can present it to you. At the moment, when it pops up that little box and shows you who it's from, that is a pet name. The thing where pet names become interesting is where when you introduce somebody else, you know, when Alice tells Bob, this is my friend Carol, it's Alice's name for Carol that Bob can use to decide who this person is, should he really talk to them, how should he describe them. So I haven't implemented it yet, but it'll be pretty easy. In the reference node that gets sent over, to include a name, the name that's sent over is basically whatever Alice uses for that person. So it's not trying to do, you know, kind of a web of things. It's only one hop deep. But those names are pet names, and there's a section in the paper about specifically that paper and about Zuko's paper describing those three kinds of names. Basically, the key ID is the key. The addresses that point to it are the address, and the pet name is the pet name.
Do you have software for running mailing lists?
Not yet, no. You can see from the protocol how that would work. Mailing lists are just another identity. The whole thing is implemented in Python, and the agent is just kind of a module that you pull in. So you could translate it into, or you could add that to mailing list software without too much trouble.
You talked about other anti-spam systems mm-hmm. being vulnerable to Outlook viruses mm-hmm. and taking over computers. Have you thought about attacks against pet mail by someone who uses a virus to co-opt a million computers and get a million identities and maybe fool a million users into mm-hmm. Typing in extra captchas?
Yes. There's a bit more information on that on the paper on the website. Basically, if you take over somebody's computer who's running pet mail, you get their private key. And then you can send out mail as if it's coming from that person. That lets you, as the spammer, spam everybody who actually trusts that person. And it lets you introduce new spammers to that person. So like in the example I showed before, that's why the lineage keeps track of all of this stuff. And you can say, hey, I seem to be getting spam from, you know, Bob's machine. You can turn him off, or you can rate limit him down to, say, one message a day. A feature I've been thinking about adding would be to add a note to that. So if the permission that you apply to somebody can have an extra little note that gets popped up when you go and violate the permission. So if Bob's machine gets taken over, you can put some text into your address book entry for him, and then when he tries to send too many messages per day, he'll get a message that pops up that says, hey, this is Alice, I think somebody's taken over your computer, go fix it. But then the lineage checking lets you mitigate the effects of that. It's kind of a trade-off between trying to make standard human patterns, you know, introduction, very smooth, and trying to be able to contain the damage when something like that happens. Some of the other attacks possible would be people trying to attack ticket servers, people trying to run fake ticket servers, things like that. But mostly because the ticket servers only let you send one message to one person, the damage of that is far reduced than it is in a scheme where being able to forge one identity lets you send out mail to the, you know, forging a trusted identity or taking over a machine on a validated network, like in some of the SPF schemes, lets you send mail to the entire world.
I don't know that much about a lot of the spam protection systems, but I'm under the impression that there's proposals to include a token that proves you've spent X amount of compute cycles to mm-hmm. generate this email. Mm-hmm. It seems like with all the discussions of ways to defeat CAPTCHAs, that's what this is essentially, right? Or how is this different and better mm-hmm. than that, and given that you have to break SMTP compatibility?
Right. Because it's spending human time, because it's not letting spammers take advantage of all the computers that they can own.
Well, that assumes that the CAPTCHA really has to get answered by a human rather than X number of compute cycles.
Correct. And that is why I'm trying to abstract it out and basically say that there's a server that provides you with this service and that research will improve over time to find better schemes. If the compute cycles, part of it is also a complexity thing. You know, you can imagine schemes where you put up four pictures and say, which one is the dog? And hard to imagine how you can beat that with a bunch of compromised machines. You need actual research and actual pattern recognition, you know, research time, human time, intellectual time to kind of beat that. So, yeah, it's a difficult problem. My assumption or the design goal is to make sure that it's a sender's human time for receiver's human time and to find a way to take the computers out, remove their amplification abilities for that.
Is there a revocation recovery system such that maybe I could set up my own little CA so I've got a key I keep secret and I assign myself a key so that I can use with the system so that such that Outlook breaks, a virus gets my private key, I can then revoke it and then issue myself a new one?
I haven't put any energy into that yet. One thing that I've thought of is to put a passphrase in there so, you know, your key and everything else is encrypted in there as you start it. But clearly if somebody is specifically attacking pet mail, then they'll just watch for that key as you type it in and send it out. No, that's a hard one. I haven't figured out a way to deal with that yet. A lot of this is based upon the idea that if somebody owns your computer, they own you, and not trying to protect against somebody. You know, in a typical system without real capabilities, there's not much you can do to differentiate me versus somebody owning my computer.
And we have time for two more questions.
Do you have a rough estimate by when you expect SERP support to be available?
For what?
Do you have a rough estimate by when you expect SERP support, remailer support to be available?
Probably a couple of months. I'm talking with Nick about some enhancements to the Mixminion client to be able to do this right. We need to be able to identify each SERP as it gets used so that we can put a limit on how many SERPs are out there in the wild to prevent a flooding attack. But I have the code right now to create SERPs and to decrypt things with them as they come back in. So there's enough code in there right now that it's not tested yet, but you should be able to use a SERP to send mail to somebody. The next step is actually creating those SERPs and stocking them with somebody else. The SERP server is pretty simple because it doesn't have to do any of the email stuff. It just has to, you know, feed out these SERPs. So, yeah, I figure a couple of months to kind of get those protocols nailed down and implemented.
Actually, you already have the solution to the CA problem that somebody mentioned because you have the introducer. You can just tell people that you should only accept my root key as the introducer and these other keys are not valid introducers. And so then you keep your root key offline. And then when you're compromised, that becomes a valid introducer and you can use it.
Yeah, that's a good point. With respect to the introduction process, only somebody who's in your address book can serve as an introducer, and only if you've clicked the button on there that says, trust this person to do introductions. So if somebody tells you, hey, my computer has been taken over, then you know they go and turn that flag off until you get everything cleaned up. One thing I'm planning on is a way of changing keys to send a message signed by the old one to say, here's my new one. And you could use something like that along with an extra human verification step to automate the process. One nice thing about having the agent there to do all of this stuff for you is that it can then automate the process of updating everybody with those changes. That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you much.